Yeah, it's 7:30. Okay. I need to stop talking. Get to teaching. Okay. Good to see everybody. Don't look at that clock because it is stuck at 7:15. So turn your Bibles to Revelation 7. Revelation 7. Okay. Now, for those of you who are visiting, what we're doing is we are overviewing the book of Revelation right now. This whole quarter has been an overview of Hebrews through Revelation. So, you know, it's a lot of work, but it's good. It's good. So, we're going to try to cover chapters, really 7 through 11 tonight. Just kind of get the big picture, all right? Now, we saw in Revelation 1 that John had a vision of what or whom?
God, right? Yeah. Holy Spirit.
That's right. So he had a vision of a lot of things. The most prominent thing was the glorified Christ. Chapters 2 and 3, what do we have?
The
churches. That's right. The seven churches of Asia, the letters to the seven churches of Asia. All right, and then in chapters 4 and 5, remember?
Throne scene.
So the throne scene and the scroll in God's hand that was sealed with seven seals. And then there's this lamb that had been slain that is worthy to break the seven seals.
The only one.
And the only one. And this is the Christ, and this is the coronation of the Christ. Okay, so there's great rejoicing in heaven. And then we start to see these seven seals be broken, all right? And that is that we see that start in chapter 6, okay? And so with the first four seals that are broken, we saw the four horsemen. And I'm using images because this is such a visual book, and I've gone to a lot of trouble to try to help us to visualize it with these images. Then the fifth seal, do you remember what the fifth seal involved? The saints under the altar. And what are they asking? That's right. How long, O Lord, till you avenge our blood for those who have killed us? And so, in answer to their prayer, we have at the sixth seal, you know, things like the sun darkened and the moon turned to blood and great earthquake and so forth. This is the concept of a great upheaval of a society, God's judgment upon a nation. Okay? So that's God's answer. So God's judgment upon Rome, that's the context primarily of the book of Revelation, was something that he was doing in part as a response of the request of his saints. Okay? The prayers of his saints. We're going to see that more as we continue. Okay? So that's pretty much where we left off. So now what we're going to do is starting in chapter 7, and we're not reading every verse. There'd be no way we could get through it by the end of the month if we do that. What we see here is there are four angels, and what are they holding back? They're holding back the four winds of destruction. And what are they holding it back for? What is something that has to happen before they release these four winds? That's right. The saints have to be sealed, okay? And how many are there? 144,000, and the Jehovah's Witnesses have this all figured out, don't they? Yes. This is not literal, okay? Everything in Revelation, and when I say everything, you understand what I mean. It is full of symbols. Even the numbers are symbols. So we can't pick and choose. Well, I'm going to take, you know, this symbol symbolically, but I'm going to take this symbol literally. That's what people do throughout Revelation. You can't do that. If it's a symbol, then we have to take it symbolically and see what the literal truth behind that symbol is. Okay? So, first of all, the concept that they are sealed on their foreheads. Okay? Not literal, but it's the symbol, it's the idea of being identified as belonging to God. God has identified you. He knows who are His. They're not going to be protected from all suffering. Are Christians protected from all suffering?
No.
But even if we die, Are we going to be all right? Are we still going to belong to God? Are we still sealed? That's the point. Notice that these 144,000 are on the earth. So these, I think this number represents the totality of God's people on earth. 12 is a number representing the people of God. All that 144,000 is 12 times 12 times 1,000. Okay? So you've got these 12 tribes listed. So that means these are just Jewish people, right? It's a symbol. If we take it literally, we have to say only Jews. And none of them from the tribe of Dan are listed. So, sorry, they missed out. Now, that's one of the interesting things. If you kind of just look here at in chapter 7 and verses 5 through 8, and we're not going to go into it. If we were doing a detailed class, we could. But the tribe of Dan is missing. And so instead of the tribe of Dan, you have the tribe of Levi. Well, Levi in the Old Testament was never listed with the 12 tribes. The Levites were spread among all the tribes. Okay? I simply point that out to show you that is one clear indicator this is not literal. Okay? If it were literal, you'd have to have Dan. And you wouldn't have an even 12,000 for each tribe because the tribes were vastly different in size. Right? Okay? So it's not literal. It represents the idea of the Israel of God today. Who is the Israel of God?
Christians.
Saints. That's right. Who follow in the faith of Abraham. Okay? That's what the symbol here, I believe, is to represent. So here are those on the earth that belong to God, sealed for God. Then, beginning of verse 9, John sees another group. And what is this group?
Innumerable.
An innumerable host standing before the throne. From every nation, clothed in white robes, praising God and praising the Lamb. The angels, the elders, the living creatures join in the worship. These are those who've already passed from this life to the next. These are the ones that are already victorious on the other side. It's so important. You know, the book of Revelation is practical. That we, being the saints who are sealed of God, as it were, you know, that symbol can be true as it were it was in the days of the first century for any generation, if we apply that concept, okay? We don't need to just pay attention to this life and get down and discouraged all the time because of how bad things are here. They're bad a lot of times. But you know what? If you serve God, if you're sealed by Him on the other side, things are great. And things are going to be great for you too. And we have to keep that balance and that perspective. And I want to read the end of the chapter. We can't skip over these verses, 15 through 17. For this reason, they are before the throne of God, and they serve Him day and night in His temple. And He who sits on the throne will spread His tabernacle over them. They will hunger no more, nor thirst any more, nor will the sun beat down on them, nor any heat. For the Lamb in the center of the throne will be their shepherd and will guide them to springs of the water of life, and God will wipe every tear from their eyes. I plan to preach a lesson soon on heaven, and one of the points I want to make, a little spoiler alert here, one of the best things about heaven is there will be nothing bad there. As that's emphasized in Revelation over and over. Know this, know that, none of the bad things. Hunger, thirst, those are things that they were experiencing, that Christians were experiencing at that time. No tears in heaven. Well, God's going to wipe every tear. And so think about that. When you meditate on heaven, and you need to do that, we all need to do that, think about what will not be in heaven. That'll give you a lot of joy. Okay? All right. Now, that's through the end of chapter 7. Any comments or questions? Before we go into chapter 8. Okay, now we're kind of ramping up to the seventh seal, but it's going to take a little while to get there, okay? So in the beginning of chapter 8, there is silence for how long in heaven?
Half an hour.
Half an hour. Don't ask me why. I don't know. It's just, that's what it says. This is kind of like the calm before the storm, okay? Okay? Seven angels are each given a what? A trumpet. So that they can play songs? For what? For warning. Yes, trumpets are for warning. Now, the sounding of these trumpets that we're about to see are part of the seventh seal. Okay? So you have these seven seals. At the seventh seal, you have seven trumpets. At the end of the seventh trumpet, we're going to see seven bowls of wrath. So there are going to be three sets of seven. Three sets of seven. All right? But anyway, we'll get to all that later. So there's another angel besides these seven that comes with a golden censer. What's a censer?
It's a bowl.
It's a bowl, okay? Like it'd be like brass or it could be some other metal. And what do you have in that bowl?
Incense.
Yes, so you have coals and you have incense on those coals. And in the Old Testament, what is the symbol of incense? What is that to kind of represent?
Sweet aroma.
It's a sweet aroma. But it's the idea of our prayers going up before God, okay? That's at least part of the symbolism of what incense represents. So here you have this angel adding incense to the prayers of the saints. Read a lot about the prayers of the saints in Revelation. So that it's all wrapped up in this idea of prayer. And God then answers the prayer of the saints, the prayers of the saints. And in response, the same angel then goes and gets coals from the altar, takes fire from the altar, and throws it where?
To the earth.
Throws it upon the earth. And then there are great consequences. There's thunder and lightning and an earthquake. And then, that hasn't even started the first trumpet yet. That's just kind of like a preview. Okay? Now we're getting ready for the actual thing. So you have the seven angels ready. And the first trumpet in chapter 8 and verse 7. Okay, so let's read that verse. The first sounded, and there came hail and fire mixed with blood. I don't know if that means it's like raining blood. That's the picture I get. That sounds kind of gross and scary. And they were thrown to the earth, and a third of the earth was burned up, and a third of the trees were burned up, and all the green grass was burned up. So this idea of a partial devastation. So there are going to be a lot of survivors. Now, if this is a trumpet of warning, then what do you think the survivors ought to do as a result of all this calamity?
Take heed.
They ought to take heed. They ought to look inward and say, man, am I ready for death? Is my life right? So that's what these trumpets ultimately are going to make the point of, is the need for those survivors to take heed and to take warning. It's a trumpet of warning. Now, these calamities were sent by God because they were part of His judgment on a wicked society. Sometimes God sends calamities purposefully. I don't know, whether it be an earthquake or a tornado or some natural calamity like that. I think that there is scriptural precedent that God sends some of those. But we also know that we live in a fallen world. And we know that, you know, bad things just happen as a result of living in a fallen world as well. Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 11 says, time and chance happen to them all. Okay? So, in other words, when there's some calamity, I don't think it's our job to point at that and say, look what God did. Why did God do that to me? Like He did it on purpose. We don't know. But what we can do is take heed. We can treat it like it's a trumpet of warning. Okay? Anytime there's a calamity, anytime there's destruction and death on a large scale or something like that, treat it like a trumpet of warning and take heed to yourself. Too many people don't do that. Okay? Second trumpet, verses 8 and 9. The second angel sounded, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea. That's just, I think, a way of describing a volcano. And a third of the sea became blood, and a third of the creatures in the sea which were in the sea that had life died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. So you see some similarities here. It's a third. It's not total devastation. There are survivors, right? Now, in Jeremiah 51, a volcano is used to describe the fall of what empire?
Babylon.
Okay, that's pretty powerful. It's powerful imagery. So this is a typical, well, this is the type of language that was used in the Old Testament in apocalyptic literature. It's now used in the book of Revelation to, I think, make the same point. This is the idea of the fall of a political state. What was the political state at the time?
Rome.
Yes, Rome. Interesting that, you know, this is written in such a way that if you weren't a Christian and you didn't know the Old Testament, you didn't know that thing that I just told you about Jeremiah 51, you wouldn't know what in the world this is talking about. But if you understand the little clues, you can put it together. Oh, this is talking about the destruction of Rome. Because if there was a writing disseminated among Christians about Rome being destroyed, you think that'd be good for the Christians if Rome found out about that? But Rome's not going to figure this one out. Okay? So I think that's a part of why this is written in the way that it is. Fourth one, right? Third. Third in verses 10 and 11. The third trumpet sounds, okay? So verses 10 and 11, you have something fall on the rivers and springs. And what is it? It's a great star. Now we read in Isaiah 14 the description of the fall of the king of Babylon. He's even called Lucifer. That is not referring to Satan. That's a very common misconception. It's talking in the context about the king of Babylon. Okay? The star of the morning, Lucifer. So the fall of a monarch. That's the point. All right, now verse 12. The fourth trumpet. You have a third of the luminaries, the sun, moon, and stars, are smitten or stricken. And so we saw that back in the sixth seal, we saw similar. You had the sun darken and the moon, you know, turn to blood, and this idea of the great upheaval of society. This is similar. This is a little different because what portion of the luminaries is smitten? A third. So it's not total devastation. It's enough that it ought to do what? It ought to get your attention. See, isn't that interesting how God works? How he will do enough to get your attention. And then it doesn't get people's attention. But it needs to get our attention and cause us to look inwardly. Then, verse 13, there's an eagle flying in the mid-heaven. So, you know, not up where God is and not just right above us, but he's up there. He's way up there. And this is a talking eagle. And he shouts, whoa, 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 W-O-E, to those who dwell upon the earth, because the blast of the three angels that have not yet sounded. So what we've seen thus far is pretty bad, but it doesn't hold a candle to what's about to happen. These last three trumpets of warning are going to be a lot worse. Okay? A lot worse. So that's the end of chapter 8. I'm going at a pretty good clip. Does anybody have anything you want to add or any questions? Is everything making sense? There's a lot to take in all at once. But sometimes you get lost in the details. And it's good to back up and kind of see the bigger picture. Yeah, Terry.
So some of these, you know, it looks like it could be taken literal, like a volcano. Maybe was there a volcano in that time that erupted?
Yeah, Pompeii. Yeah, and they would have known of that. Yeah, Mount Vesuvius.
And that destroyed part of Rome?
Well, it would. No, it didn't destroy part of Rome, but it was close to this area in Asia Minor. They would have known about it. I think that is the primary application. Yeah.
So even all these, like, none of this is literal. Like, it wasn't a volcano that
turned on. No. None of this is literal. The symbols are never literal. The symbols are always symbolic. But yeah, I think that primarily it's talking about Rome. But again, history repeats itself. I mean, there have been Romes and Romes and Romes, right? And they have their falls. They all fall, right? And it's all the same story over and over. And so we see history repeat itself, and these same principles apply in various ways in America and every other nation and all nations of all time. But it was written to first century saints. So, good question. Okay, good. Any other thoughts on that? Any other questions on that?
Was Pompeii like recent, or was it long ago?
It was AD 79, and this is, I think, AD 96. So, you know, close enough that some could definitely remember it. It would have been very vivid in their minds, some of their minds, no doubt. Okay, very good. All right, now going into chapter 9, the fifth trumpet, starting in verse 1, we see a star falling from heaven. This is the second star falling from heaven. This one is not describing the fall of like a ruler like we saw earlier, because this one goes on with a specific description. It took me a little while to kind of figure this one out. This star is given the key to the bottomless pit. And when you follow the language, that's what it's saying. So the star is personified. It's all a symbol anyway. So typically what people do, and I think there's validity to this, is they connect this star to verse 11. Okay? And so look there at verse 11. It mentions these has king over them, the angel of the abyss. His name in Hebrew is Abaddon, which means destruction. And in the Greek, he has the name Apollyon, which means destroyer. This is some kind of spirit being that is not pleasant. Okay? He's evil. I don't know if you'd say this is Satan. I think that's the typical view, right? That's the typical view. I think that's a valid view. But all I know is it calls him an angel. And I don't know of any other place Satan is called an angel, if this is talking about Satan. But it's some kind of evil spirit being. So that seems to be what the star itself was, that it's connected with that same spirit being. So here's what he looked like. In case you were wondering, I got a picture of it. All right. He opens the pit and great smoke boils out. So much smoke that it darkens the sun and the air. And then out of this smoke come these really horrible locusts. And again, this takes us back to some, you know, symbolic language. And, you know, the book of Joel? It talks about locusts, the locust plague. But these locusts are different. I want to read about the description in chapter 9, 7 through 10. All right? Yeah, chapter 9, verses 7 through 10. And this is how I saw in the... No, that's not right. Where am I? Horrible locusts. Okay. Chapter 8. Okay. Chapter 9. Verses 7. Okay, yeah. I don't know what I was doing. Oh, I was looking at verse 17. Yeah. Okay, sorry about that. Verse 7, the appearance of the locusts was like horses prepared for battle. And on their heads appeared to be crowns like gold. And their faces were like the faces of men. So they've got these crowns, which indicates what? Victory. All right? So they're experiencing a degree of victory, or at least the appearance of victory. They had hair like the hair of women. Verse 8, which seems to indicate perhaps there was something alluring about them. There was something attractive about them that drew you to them. Something beautiful about them. Their teeth were like the teeth of lions. They're ferocious. They had breastplates like the breastplates of iron. So they seemed to be invincible. And the sound of their wings was like the sound of chariots of many horses running to battle. So they're fierce, and there's a lot of them. They have tails like scorpions and stings, and in their tails is the power to hurt men for 5 months. So these locusts can cause tremendous pain. All right? Now, I believe what these represent are the hellish influences of sin, the physical consequences of sin in men's lives. Because who are protected from these scorpions, these locusts? Those who've been sealed by God. Now, those who've been sealed by God are not, we're not protected from suffering in general, but are we protected in a sense from the consequences of habitual sin and the painful consequences of that in our lives? If we're really serving God, absolutely. You know, our lives are like a fairy book life to the way that the world lives and the pain that they bring upon themselves. So the idea, I think, is that God turns the wicked, unregenerate world over to their sin. Read Romans chapter 1. And I think that's basically what that's representing. The consequences of sin. That ought to get people's attention. When your life becomes, you know, a country song and it's, everything's going wrong and you're messing your life up and it's all because of your sin, then that ought to make you stop and say, hey, you know, I ought to change the path that I'm on. But more often than not, people don't do it. They just keep on going in the same path. Okay? All right, then we have the sixth trumpet. Starting in verse 13, we see God's army of destruction. Now, I like to kind of compare these two armies, all right? So we have these angels. Remember the angels that were holding back the four winds? Well, they're still holding those four winds, but now they're released. And God's enormous army goes forth. How many is listed as the number? 200 million. Now, in premillennialism, you know, they take that literally, and this is, you know, talking about a literal battle at the end of time and so forth. No, this is not literal. It just means a lot, okay? In this case, it's a whole lot, okay? And look at the description of these warriors and their horses in chapter 9, verse 17. This is what I was trying to read earlier, and I couldn't find where I was. And this is how I saw, John says, and this is how I saw in the vision the horses and those who sat on them. The riders had breastplates the color of fire and of hyacinth and of brimstone. So let's just kind of pause there for a second and kind of put an image up here. All right, so first of all, you've got the color of fire, which would be red. You've got the color of hyacinth, which is like a dark purple. And the color of brimstone, which is like a sulfur color, like a yellowish color. Now, think of what these represent. Fire, smoke, and brimstone. Fire, smoke, and brimstone. What does that bring to your mind?
Hell.
Fire and brimstone, right? This is God taking judgment, inflicting wrath, right, on the wicked. The heads of the horses are like the heads of lions. Now, who do you think would win? A locust or a lion? A lion. Lions are powerful, right? And out of their mouths proceed fire and smoke and brimstone. How about that? That's what I was kind of telling you a second ago. So that's the picture. That's the symbol here is God's wrath. And also look at the end of verse 19, it says, for their tails are like serpents and have heads, and with them they do harm. So these are more ferocious, powerful soldiers than those locusts that we read about, as fierce as they were. Okay? This is God's army. This is a symbol of God inflicting wrath and executing his power and so forth. How many of mankind, what percentage, what fraction of mankind dies? A third. All right? So this is not total destruction. And then those that are left that don't die, what do they refuse to do?
Repent.
They refuse to repent. That's the same point that I've been making. Okay? And so that's sad when that happens. All right. That's through the end of chapter 9. Any questions? Terry?
You seem to have an idea, generally speaking, what all the numbers kind of symbolize. Is there, with the flying beast, the 5 months, is that?
I don't know of any symbolism of the 5 months other than, boy, if you could get stung and it hurts you for 5 months, that's a long time. But I don't know anything else on the five. That's a good... Now, we will see, like, you know, like 42 months, which is 3.5 years, which is a broken seven, and things like that. But I don't know of anything to put with five. Now, four, a lot of times four represents the earth, like north, south, east, west, you know, the four corners of the earth that the angels are holding back. So a lot of times, you know, we can assign meaning to numbers, but I think sometimes it's a little hard to do that. So I'm careful in those cases.
Adam, history says that Jerusalem was besieged for 1,260 days, which is 3.5 years, which is 42 months. It's the same. It's times and half a time.
Yeah.
They're all the same. But that would be a time that Christians, because of the affinity with Judaism, would have a recollection of what that meant.
Oh, okay, good. I had never thought of that. So that's interesting. And I mean, I think ultimately the background for that, and we'll talk more about this in a minute, is the Book of Daniel. Like you said, times, and half a time. Well, one and then one time, and then two times, and then half a time is 3.5. So we see 3.5 in Revelation a lot. But I like that point, Jack. I never knew that. So, okay, very good. So going into chapter 10 now. What do we see at the beginning of chapter 10? This angel. And he's a big one, right? He's a strong angel. He's very large. He puts one foot in the sea and one on the earth. And what has he got in his hand? A little book. Is that like a codex book or is that like a scroll?
Scroll.
It's a scroll. That's what this means. Okay? They didn't have books like this, I don't think, yet. But anyway. And so John hears the seven thunders utter their voices. So you got thunders speaking, right? And John's writing everything he sees and hears, right? So he starts writing this down, what's God telling him to do? Don't do that. Seal it up. I think the point of that is the secret things belong to the Lord our God, but the things that are revealed belong to us and our children. So Deuteronomy 29:29. There are some things that God has chosen not to reveal yet. And maybe we'll find out in heaven. But that's just interesting, that little thing there. All right. Then the angel lifts his right hand to heaven and he swears by God that there will what? There'll be delay no longer, okay? So we've been waiting on that seventh trumpet. And so we got to watch for that seventh trumpet because that's when God will send his wrath upon the wicked. That's when he will vindicate the righteous. By that time, there will be no more delay. So the angel tells John, beginning in verse 8, to take this book and do something with it. What's he telling him to do?
Eat it.
So eat this book. Now that's bizarre, but this is all bizarre. So this book, he takes it and he just munches it down. He just, you know, eats this book. And how's it taste?
Sweet.
Man, that is one tasty book. I like that scroll. But then how did he feel?
Bitter.
His stomach was bitter. Have you ever eaten something that tasted really good going down? And then later you regretted it? It was really bitter in your stomach, so to speak? So he's experiencing that. Now, is there an Old Testament background of a prophet in the Old Testament? Ezekiel, chapter 3, beginning of that chapter. Same thing. He's told to eat a scroll and he eats it and it's sweet. And that's the idea that he's going to prophesy against the people of God. So John is then told to measure the temple of God and its altar and those who worship there. Well, what would the literal truth behind this symbol be? To measure the temple. Yes. Yes. And who is the temple? What is the temple in, you know, practical terms? That's right. We are. So if we're being measured, it's the idea, are we living up, are we measuring up to God's standards? When we take God's word and use it as a measure, you know, as a measuring stick, are we lining up to what the word of God says? So that's the truth behind the symbol. That's also something you see in Zechariah 2 and Ezekiel 40 through 48. All this is so rich when you go back into the Old Testament. God then sends two witnesses, and they testify during this period of time that the courts of the temple are being treaded underfoot by the Gentiles. Persecution of the church for 3.5 years, 42 months. Shorter than they might have expected it to last, right? A broken seven, not a perfect period of time. So you've got these two witnesses testifying during that same period, 1,260 days. Well, that's 3.5 years. That's 42 months. And they are also called what in verse 4, these two witnesses?
Olive trees.
They're called olive trees and two lampstands. Now, lamps had to have oil. So if you had a lamp and you needed olive oil, what if that lamp was connected to or right there with an olive tree? Do you think it'd be okay? Zechariah 4 is the background for this. Read that prophecy. It's fascinating. So the idea is that God will accomplish his purpose. He's not going to be stopped. And so even though you've got the Gentiles treading the courts and you've got all this persecution and suffering going on, God's got his two witnesses out there, and they're not going to be stopped till they finish their task. In fact, they're going to be protected. I want to read the description in verses 5 and 6 of chapter 11. And if anyone wants to harm them, fire comes out of their mouth and devours their enemies. So if anyone wants to harm them, he must be killed in this way. You remember when Elijah called down fire from heaven in the Old Testament? It didn't come out of his mouth, but this is similar. Verse 6, these have power to shut up the sky so that rain will not fall during the days of their prophesying. Who does that remind you of? Elijah, praying that the rain would stop and then come back. And they have power over the waters to turn them into blood and to strike the earth with every plague as often as they desire. Who does that remind you of?
Moses
and the plagues. So we have Elijah and Moses, you know, the idea of the law and the prophets, okay, kind of the symbol that backs these two witnesses. Ultimately, these two witnesses perhaps represent the inspired prophets and the apostles. That here Christ has done his work, and he's this conquering, you know, king going forth on his white horse to conquer, and his gospel is going to go forth. God is going to accomplish his purpose, even though the Gentiles are treading underfoot the courts of the temple. Even though this suffering and persecution is going on, the Christians in the first century needed to know and be reminded God's purposes are not going to be thwarted. Rome is not going to be able to stop God's purposes. Satan is not going to be able to stop God's purposes. We have to remember that. America is not going to stop God's purposes. Right? Your co-workers are not going to stop God's purposes. His will is going to be done. His purposes are going to, you know, be accomplished. And I think that's ultimately what these two witnesses symbolize. They are killed, and then what does God do? He raises them from the dead, takes them to heaven after 3.5 days. Shorter than might have been expected. So anyway, I think Josh is ready to ring the bell. I almost got through chapter 11, so I got into chapter 11. Please read through chapter 16. We got to fly through Revelation, so I need you to study that and read through whatever page that is for chapter 16. Through like page 145. Okay? So through page 145 and study through chapter 16 for Sunday. Thanks, everybody.